Hey folks, welcome to the Wrench Turners Podcast, a show that's about improving the life, well-being, and productivity of mechanics everywhere. I am your host, Mr. Joshua Taylor, and today, on today's show, we get to talk with a content creator and shop owner that gets to work out of his own garage, working on some of the most awesome stuff that we get to see in the background right there, Hunter Layton, also known as Motorcycle Guy. Hunter, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. How are you?
Awesome, awesome, awesome. Now, Hunter, a couple of questions. One, I see what I believe to be a Husky black box, and I see a Husky blue box in the background. Do you squeak when you walk like me? Right?
Depends on what shoes I'm wearing.
Are you that frugal guy that looks for the deal every single time that you hunt for a tool?
You know, I used to be. But at this point, I've got so many tools that right now, all the tools that I have are special tools is what I'm buying mainly now. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've got everything from Princess Auto, which is the Canadian version of Harbor Freight, all the way up to Snap-on, Mac, K&L, and everything in between. All right. Mm-hmm. Actually, I just bought some custom tools this weekend at the trade show from this local machinist. So,
awesome. Yeah. Awesome. That's really cool.
Actually, funny you should ask that. I had a few comments recently, and then my brother, of all people, just shamed me for my Ryobi bit driver. I'm like, well, I didn't buy it because I'm cheap. I bought it because I had a bunch of batteries for them.
Hey, I bought my very first cordless impact on special because it was a reduced sale. It was an open box. It had nothing else. It was just the cordless. It didn't even have a battery. Mm. So I bought that, and I think it was paid like $20 for it. And that was DeWalt. Yeah. And ever since then, I've just continued to buy DeWalt things because I have the batteries for them, right? Mm. So the batteries are so bloody expensive. It doesn't make sense to try and change everything. Yeah. Right now I understand it's a little bit different. Like 15 years ago, 10 years ago, when cordless impacts became a thing, you can get adapters for the damn things, and it doesn't matter as much, but I digress. So he was giving you shit for it, eh?
Yeah, well, I mean, he's also an electrician, right? So
Sparkies.
Yeah.
Sparks. So, I get you.
Really good guy, but I don't think he meant anything negative by it, but he's probably the only person in the world that if he says I need to go buy something, I'll go buy it.
Oh, okay, fair.
Yeah.
Well, if that's the case, and he's rubbing like on a probably a fairly regular basis, he's probably giving you a hard time. Is he the same person that, you know, got you into the trade, like, or into a trade, or how did that transpire? How did you get into the trade, and did you actually start with motorcycles?
Yeah. So, well, ever since I was a child, I've always really liked motorcycles. Now we couldn't really afford them as a kid growing up. Right. So it was always like, you know, as a kid, you're riding your bicycle, you're imagining it's that motorcycle. Right. I think what got me interested in them in the first place was, of all things, Terminator 2 and Mission Impossible 2. Right. So there's like, you know, cool bike scenes with those two movies that, well, when you're a little kid, it really captivates you. Right. But what got me into the trade was in high school is trying to figure out what I'm going to do. Right. I didn't like the idea of taking out student loans to go to university. And I just didn't really know what to do, but most of my family are tradespeople, right? My dad and my stepdad were machinists forever. My brother's an electrician. So yeah, it's like, well, maybe I should get some kind of trade, right? And like learn how to work with my hands. So I got this brochure with a list of a couple hundred different Red Seal trades. And I saw that motorcycle mechanics was an actual Red Seal trade. So all throughout high school, I was trying to get into the RAP program. It's a thing in Alberta, the Registered Apprenticeship Program, where basically you get your part of your schooling and your work experience, and you get a kickstart on your apprenticeship while you're still in high school. But it did work, right? So they didn't want to take a RAP student program guy. So in grade 12, I met a guy that worked at one of the local dealerships, and he got me a job starting at the parts desk. While I was in grade 12, and I was so bad at the parts desk that they just moved me into the shop, right? And so, and then fortunately, though, they started counting my hours all towards the apprenticeship. And yeah, just the whole first year, second year too, even, it's you're just doing the chores, you know? So you're sweeping the floors, you're running bikes in and out and just doing whatever they need you to do as the apprentice, right? And then as I got better and they got a little more comfortable with me, then they started giving me simple jobs like oil changes, tire changes, the stuff that they don't want to tie up the journeyman's time with. So I was doing a lot of that. And then fortunately, they paid for my schooling as well. All right. So,
Nice. So just a quick quantification. So I did, obviously I'm not continuing, but a year and change ago, I did my level one here in Ontario in motorcycle. And it's two levels here in Ontario. It's literally basically beginner and advanced. It's 2 8-week sessions and that's it. Is it the same in Berta?
No, it's a 4-year program or 4-year apprenticeship.
No. It's still 4 years. You still got to quantify the same amount of hours, but it's literally only two levels of school that you have to quantify for.
Oh, really?
That's it.
No, here it's four. Yeah. Yeah. You got your first year, you get your hours and then your school all the way up to fourth year. And then after that, you write two tests, your journeyman certificate, which is the one for Alberta. And then you write another one, the Red Seal, which is for all of Canada.
Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, I think
you get, now here in Ontario, it's, you get your Red Seal if you get over 90, if I recall.
Okay.
That's how I got mine. Cause I think I got like a 94 or whatever on my CFQ.
Nice.
So I got my Red Seal when I got mine in, geez, when I write, I think I wrote in 07. I think I got mine for automotive, not from, for motorcycle. So I did a year and a half, almost 2 years at the power sports store just up the street from my house.
Nice.
And I've always wanted a motorcycle. Like since I was wee, I've always wanted a motorcycle. And with my mother being a nurse, it's like it's the two-wheeled transplant machine, right? So
yeah.
and then of course I started dating my then obviously girlfriend. We've been together for 23 years. Her mom was an ER nurse and has been an OR nurse most of her life. So again, it just reinforces the two-wheeled transplant machine. And then I guess last August, my wife looked at me. He's like, "You want a motorcycle, don't you?" He's like, "Yes, I need a motorcycle." So while working at the power sports store, I finally got my first one, a 765R, and I love it to death. And I didn't even
that's
get
quite a bit of bike. Yeah.
Well, I looked at it this way: I'm 40. I have, yes, I can be an absolute idiot. Some may think more often than others, but I can control myself enough that I am not just jamming on that throttle every single chance I get. I can feather it in. I understand what that concept means, which means that as I progress through my confidence level and my capability level, because I'm going to try and do some of the courses, I understand that here in Ontario, there's a couple of race programs that's like a race training. So you understand how to lean into the bike and how to really dig into how the bike is used. I want to try and get into some of that. And that way, once I get, shall we say, above amateur level, I can start wringing its neck and be confident, and I'm not going to get bored quickly. And that was my fear, that I'm going to spend, you know, I'm going to spend $15,000 on a brand new bike. Or more specifically, if we dial it back, the 500s and the 650s that I was looking at, I'm going to spend 10 or 11 on a brand new bike and then in a year be bored. I'd rather spend 15 on a bike and be like, maybe all we really need to do is upgrade the bike a little bit. Like, I don't mind upgrading a little bike and then push the absolute limits. And from what I understand, like, even those that are, I'm diatribing here a little bit, but even those that go for a period of time, they go up to things like the speed triple, where they go to a 1050 and, you know, 170 horse. Later on, they go back to the 675 or a 765 because it's just too much bike for them.
Yeah.
They want to go back to something that is daily usable and has enough power to make it go, okay, yep, go easy, right? Is that – now, I've genuinely watched you take a BART – like recently you're doing an engine series, if I recall.
Yep.
Where I think a buddy of yours is – you know, you helped him take it out and he's doing some bits and bobs and you're doing some bits and bobs. I don't think I recall what it is that you ride.
I've got, well, this DRZ 400 behind me. And actually, that was one of the engines I was working on today. And then, you can't see it because I have another buddy's bike in the way, but I've got that red thing over there. That's a 2022 Ducati V4 Street Fighter.
Nice. Okay, yeah. Cool.
And that's now, like, what was it? 17th or 18th bike.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah, I've had a few. Now,
why the turnover of the bikes? Like, is it because you get bored with it? Is it the riding style change, or?
It's a little bit of, well, there's a few things, right? Like, the first bike I had for a year, that was a Ninja 250, and then I got an R6, a Honda Shadow 750, relatively the same time. Like, I just wanted to try a whole bunch of different kinds of bikes. Because, like, mm-hmm. I was saying earlier, like, I got into bikes because of Terminator 2 and Mission Impossible 2, right? So you have a naked sport bike and then, like, a fat boy, you know?
So, gotcha. But,
yeah, the Street Fighter, like, I've always liked Ducatis, right? And actually, mm-hmm. when I was apprenticing, the dealership I was at was the Ducati dealership at the time. They're not anymore, but they were at the time. So I feel really fortunate, you know, when I was a teenager still in high school. And a few years after that, I was apprenticing on Ducatis, you know, so that was pretty neat. Yeah, I've always liked the things. So this is my third Ducati, actually. I've had another Street Fighter before that, the original version. I've had a Monster 1100. I've had a couple of Harleys. I've had everything in between, you know, so it's... I just like them, you know?
And what it seems to me, and this is something that, you know, astounds me, the difference between motorcycles and cars is, I don't know whether it's because the first value, the first retail value of new motorcycles is so significantly less than the average car that it compresses the used value, or whether it's the fact that it get so few miles on it and so few use in most cases. Obviously there's high milers out there and you know who they are. But the value of them cross platform means that you can go from one bike to another and not necessarily lose any money. Right. And, you know, as long as everything is in good nick and your maintenance is kept up, you can basically go from, you know, one $8,000 bike to another $8,000 bike. And as long as, again, it continues to be maintained, it's still roughly an $8,000 bike the next year, and until you get to that like 10, 13 year mark, and then they start to plummet in value. But, you know, you can just kind of keep going that way, and you get to experience new things. And I understand that that is a normal thing. Now, I don't know whether you saw it or not, but I got a chance to interview Mike Able Motorworks from the UK. And, I asked him, and see if you agree. Does a stable start at 3? And does a collection start at 10?
Well, to tell you the truth, I've never really thought about it like that. So when I say that's my 17th or 18th bike, that doesn't mean I've got 17 or 18 bikes. That means over the course of the last, you know, 14, 15 years, maybe not quite that long, but there's been that many. Like right now I only have the two of them, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm not sure, actually. I think it depends on who you ask, really.
Yeah, for sure. Because what I've derived from the power sports experience is that the folks that have, shall we call it a stable, you know, they'll have maybe 3 or 4, and it's the ones that they will do absolutely everything they possibly can to ride. Mm-hmm. Which means if they can be on their GS in February because there's snow on the edge of the road, but they've got full windshield, upright, knobby soft tires, heated seat, heated warmer, heated grips, the whole shebang plugged in, you know, defog helmet, they're going to ride. But mm-hmm. as soon as they can get on the street bike, they want to get on the street bike. And then if they want to go on a cruise, they hop on their Harley. Mm-hmm. And then if they want to go touring, like whatever the case would be, and they'll have like 3 or 4. And then there's the eclectics who simply want to buy things because they like it. And it's more of an art collection for them. And then they just keep buying. So I think that's kind of where my thought process comes from it, but I digress a little bit. So you were talking a bit about, you know, the first part of your career apprenticing at the Ducati store. So because it's a little bit different, but it's a little bit different, but it's a little bit not. What was that first year really like? You kind of described it a bit, and, you know, pushing the broom and so forth, but dig into it a little bit for the young folks that are going to listen. What was that year like?
I'll tell you the truth. I don't remember too much of it. Like every day kind of was more pushing brooms, another oil change, another tire change. And I'm just trying to learn as much as I can at the time. At that particular time, the first year, year and a half, like they were trying to like rush in and like hire as many techs as they can, because right around then that dealership was really rapidly expanding.
Oh, I got a thing pop up on my computer here.
Yeah, it was really rapidly expanding. So it was just trying to find your pecking order, you know what I mean? So like they had a couple mechanics, and then they hired me, moved me into the shop, and then they got rid of those guys, brought in some other guys. So there I am, like little 17, 18-year-old me. I'm thinking, I'm like, well, I've been there longer than you guys. Who are you to tell me what to do? A little bit of that. You know, but these guys,
it does not take long for that to start, does it?
No, but I mean, these guys were mechanics for like 40 years, some of them, right? So it's like, well, dude, like, you know, you're just the apprentice. I'm the 40-year master tech here.
Yeah.
But yeah, you learn pretty quick that how much you don't know, right?
Mm.
Yeah.
Especially when you get somebody like that that's been around the business for, 30, 35, 40 years. If they actually have any inclination to teach you anything, you get humbled really quickly.
Yeah.
And, you know, the ones that, you know, I recall, you know, my level 2 and level 3 automotive teacher in transmissions, I have no idea what his first name is. I'm 40 years old, and it's been almost 20 years, almost 20 years since I was taking his class, and his name's still Mr. Mantis to me. And those that happened to go to to Centennial College for automotive for block release would have had him as well. And the thing he would always use, the phrase he would always use, is like nothing. So when putting together transmissions, like in the lab at school, it's like, make sure you put a little bit of Vaseline in between, and then it'll come apart like nothing. And even when you're building the transmissions out in your shops, put a little bit of Vaseline between things, and it'll come apart like nothing, because you know it's eventually going to fail again. So that kind of thing, and that those expressions, those phrases, those little bits, those tidbits where they would go, just use some Vaseline. It's like, yeah, okay, oh yeah, oh man, it's just going to get completely wiped clean, you know, with transmission fluid. And lo and behold, you know, you go out in the real world and you use those kinds of tips appropriately, because I don't necessarily think that would necessarily fly today. But when you use those tips and tricks, you learn the, you know, maybe once a week they'll say something and it really sticks and you use it for the rest of your life. Those are really important. Yeah, they're super important. Now, since you've been there, okay, so you've been there a year, year and a half, you know, things are moving, they're trying to expand. What kind of happened between working at a dealer, a Ducati dealer nonetheless, and give us kind of like the Cole's Notes version that has you working at home, in your own shop at home, kind of, and it makes me super jealous. It makes me super jealous because it is against the law for me to do what you are doing. So much so that our back neighbors have called the cops on me having an air compressor in my back shop. Hmm. So I'm not allowed to have a business. I'm not allowed to have any of those things out of my back shop. It just kills me.
Yeah.
So tell us what's the story that's in between?
Well, ever since, like, yeah, I've always kind of had a knack for, or not really a knack, but I've always really wanted to do my own thing. Right. Cause I went through the apprenticeship program because I needed a Red Seal trade, or so that's how my mentality at the time. But before that, I was shoveling snow, I was mowing grass, just whatever I can to make my own money. Right. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I always knew kind of in the second or third year that I was going to step out on my own eventually. And at the time I saw that everything was kind of going, this was like 10 years ago. At the time I saw that everything was kind of going mobile, on demand, that kind of stuff. So I thought, well, what would be really cool? I always kept a spare toolbox in my truck because I was always helping out friends and stuff on the side. I was like, what if I just, you know, get an El Camino or a Ranchero or something, keep a toolbox in there. How cool would that be? You know, just roll up in an old muscle car like that and just help friends out that way and do it that way. So I did. I didn't have an El Camino or a Ranchero, but I had a Suburban. Right. A couple of years after I got my certificate, I went to a couple other shops. But eventually I'm just like, you know what? I'm already helping out all my friends on the side. What if I just mm-hmm. charge people for it, do other people's work. So the overwhelming majority of the work that I do actually isn't in my garage at all, right? I've got an old ambulance that I tricked out to be a mobile shop. So I'm actually a mobile mechanic. It just so happens that it's the middle of winter here in Calgary. So a lot of the work that I do is in my garage, but I'm not really supposed to. So my work is all...
I didn't put the two and two together, unfortunately, Hunter, because I was out in Calgary about 3 weeks ago.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know the day that it was minus 40 for the first time all winter? Yeah, I arrived that day.
Oh, nice.
And I was there for those 3 days where it was minus 40 for basically 3 days in a row. And then when I left, it was like minus 5, 0 degrees, kind of somewhere in there. So I was there for the three coldest days that Calgary's seen this year thus far and has seen and is likely to see. I was there on those three coldest days. So as an Ontarian that doesn't often get those days and coming to on those 3 days.
Welcome.
Anyway, I digress. So thankfully you're in a warm shop, and when you go out in mobile, you've got a nice, basically a work truck to get work out of. That's pretty cool. What is your favorite part of being mobile?
I get to be with the customer most of the time if they choose to be. Right.
Mm-hmm.
It's in a different place every day, because I find when you're working in a shop, for me at least, you get to learn what you're working on very quickly. Right. So like even at a dealership, let's say if your dealership has five different brands it deals with and each brand has 10 different bikes. Well, you learn the ins and outs of how that manufacturer does their thing, doing the same thing over and over again. And you're always working with new stuff. Right. And you never get to talk to the customers. Some shops maybe, but the shops that I was at, you never really got to talk to the customers, right? So I think that's probably my favorite part is just I know whose bike I'm working on. I can look them in the eye, you know. If there is something wrong and I have to, you know, do some extra work to it, I can show them the part. I say, hey, look, this part is worn out. And even people who are totally not mechanically inclined, if you show them, say, hey, look, this part is not supposed to be like this, they can kind of piece it together, you know. It's a lot... You know, and it just feels a lot more connected to what I'm actually doing, being able to talk to the customer directly and show them what I'm doing. And also being in a different place every day helps.
That's cool.
Yeah.
That's interesting, because there's, after almost 200 coaching sessions, there's not a whole lot of technicians. Now, I have to remember, these are technicians that are identifying that they want to get help in some way, shape, or form, and they want to improve. Typically, they just want to find – they contact me because, you know, they think I can help them find a new shop to work for, and that's never my first go-to. My first go-to is, what can we do to help you where you're at? You know, love them where they're at, teach them where they're at, get them improving where they're at, and maybe it's them, right? Maybe that's the question that they need answered and need help with. But most of them – don't want to talk to customers. And right now, you know, with the hot button topics, at least in automotive, and I'm pretty sure it's coming to power sports, it's coming to RV, it's coming to marine, it's coming to aviation. I bet you it's coming to aviation too, is doing the video walkarounds, the video MPIs, as they're called, where they're not necessarily directly communicating with the customer, but they're actively, effectively communicating with the customer, and they don't want to do it. You know, the shops that are paying for it, you know, they're still having difficulty technicians, like having difficulty getting the technicians to do it, even when they're paying for it. Because it's, you know, this isn't my job, and, or I don't want to do it because I'm not, I don't want to be talking to customers. I'm a technician. I want to fix things. It's like, well, I understand that, but part of this is, you know, transparency, integrity, showing, you know, showing the value of what we do and how we charge and things of that nature. So it's interesting to hear, fortunately for me, another person like myself that really enjoys talking with the customer, who likes to know exactly whose vehicle, whose bike, whose boat I'm working on to kind of get a better understanding. Because I think to some degree, and it doesn't apply to every shop, it doesn't apply to every industry, I think, but understanding who it is that drives or rides the thing that you're working on might give you a better understanding of what to recommend, right? So let me do this here. I'll have to, I don't know what's doing. just all of a sudden start echoing again, and it should. But we're good. I think we're okay. Anyway, being able to recommend the correct thing for the correct vehicle for the correct customer, I think gives us an elevated level of value, right? Mm-hmm. I don't know what you charge an hour, and it doesn't really matter, but the being able to communicate directly and showing the value of everything that you do means that effectively you can charge more, right? Which makes, you know, gross is important for you as a business owner. It's important for you to have a good gross. That way you can cover your extraneous bills and things like that. You have to think about yourself as effectively a flat rate technician when you're working for yourself out in there, because, you know, for every hour you work, you need to make a certain amount of gross in order to pay for the other stuff that you have to do, right? So understanding how all that works. And before we get into go too deep, perhaps down that rabbit hole, what is it like, you know, maybe just from an outside perspective for any technicians that are thinking that it's easy to be in your shoes? Would you like to enlighten some of them as to the potential challenges that you've been facing, say, in the last 10 years?
Well, I think if they might think it's a little easier for me to communicate with customers and that sort of thing, I mean, I got to be honest, I think it is a little easier in my case. And that's just solely due to the industry that I'm in, right? Just compared to automotive. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm not an automotive mechanic, but when I think automotive, I think about people like my sister, right? She works for Canada Post, and she just doesn't know anything about cars, doesn't want to know anything about cars. Her car is an appliance. So mm-hmm. when something goes wrong, it's a big deal. And, you know, she just doesn't have the money to fix it and, you know, just want it to get done now, needs to be cheap, all that. But with my industry, working on bikes, they're toys, right? So people
are a lot more, are they anything but?
Right. So it's like, you know, if something breaks on a car, for a lot of people, it's an inconvenience, right? It's an extra expense that they just don't need, especially now. But working on bikes, because they are toys here, like realistically, you know, like they're not practical when you got minus 40, right? People are just more excited to get stuff done. Right. So if something breaks, it's like, oh, then they're excited about it. They're not exactly excited, but it's like, how can I upgrade it? You know, or it's like, oh, I need tires. Well, I have these tires on. Maybe I can get these tires. They're stickier or whatever. Right. Or, you know, it's like, oh, the valves are getting done. Like, what's that look like? You know, so people are a lot more excited in that regard. So it's a little bit easier for me to communicate with them that way.
Awesome.
Yeah.
So awesome. What would you from a business perspective, you know, because this is one of those, you know, the communication, I would wholeheartedly agree that the communication is going to be tremendously easier. Mm-hmm. Now it does have, you know, certain shortfalls can happen, like any of the negative connotations to things that we do that can be viewed or misconstrued when they don't understand. Like sometimes it's quite difficult to educate a customer one-on-one exactly what needs to happen, and getting them to understand exactly what needs to happen is a challenge. But from a business perspective, you know, what are the things that you've had to learn? You know, what were maybe some of the hard lessons you had to learn to become, because you're effectively an entrepreneur, you know, working for yourself, sole proprietor, working for yourself, building a business, understanding what costs, you know, you said you've effectively transformed a meat wagon into a bike repair shop on wheels. So, you know, would you care to share or capable of sharing some of the challenges that you faced doing all of that?
Yeah. One thing, and this goes for any industry, you can't make everybody happy. All right. You're always going to get just that one job or that one customer that's just no matter what you do, they're not going to be happy. Mm-hmm. Right. And it's best to just, the reason why I bring this up right away is because I had one of those 2 years ago and he came to my booth at the show. Right. Mm-hmm. So, you know, shook his hand, how's it going? And he's like, hey, I'm going good. And nobody said anything about anything. Right. So mm-hmm. yeah, no matter what you do, you can't make everybody happy. That's one of the biggest things I've had to learn, is because I'm too much of a people pleaser. I like to make people happy. Mm-hmm. So that one's one that I had to wrap my head around. Another thing too is also, no matter what industry you're in, especially if it's just you doing everything, you're doing everything, you know? So mm-hmm. you're going to be doing a lot of things that you just don't want to do, right? For me, it's the paperwork side of things. I just can't stand it. I'd rather be hanging out with the customer, you know, fixing their bike or just doing the fun stuff like that. But the paperwork, I can't stand it. But if you're going to be an entrepreneur, you're going to have to do it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So,
and you have to get, like, you have to be organized.
Yeah.
You have to be synced with the paperwork, right?
Yeah.
The CRA, you know, they like their money,
mm.
right? It doesn't matter how they get it. They want their money. They need their money. They're going to hound you until kingdom come to get their money. And everything that they can do to try and get money out of you, they're going to do in every way, shape, and or form. And as a business owner, to be successful, you have to be eloquent with the words that you use. You have to be intelligent with the people that you hire in terms of professionals like lawyers and accountants and, you know, things of that nature. You have to be clever with how you spend your expense money. You know, it's, you know, oh, I own my own business now. I can expense that and I can expense that. Well, you actually have to have money coming in to be able to afford to pay for that.
Yeah.
And, you know, some friends on, can you make, what is it on Facebook? And I'm going to get this wrong and I'm going to get my cheeks clapped. But it's, I think it's Canadian Mechanic Hangout for the boys here. You know, somebody had posted what it actually costs when you buy equipment. And I think the example at the time they were using is, I think an alignment machine, you know, it was going to cost, you know, 40 grand or something like that for the actual machine and installation to have it operational and so on and so forth. It's not, you know, dividing your dollars per hour into that and spreading across that many hours. You have to look at things cleverly. Like if your gross is at 25%, it means that and in order to survive, you need to have a certain percentage of that gross, you know, come to you. It means that that's the number that you divide effectively the 40 grand by, not the total hour, right? And then now you see that all of a sudden a $40,000 expense requires you to basically work for 2 years at your current rate in order to pay for it. But it means that you're going to make less, so you have to somehow make more. So you have to make an extra bits of things. So then you have to get creative with how you upsell. Or as my good friend Kieran says, don't upsell, just sell, right? It's not an upcharge. It's just more selling to do. So those things that you kind of get thrown into the fire, especially as a mechanic who's never sold before, right? You are the dealership first. You never had to sell, right? And to your point, you did poorly on the parts counter, which means it sounded like you probably weren't that great a salesperson right off the bat. So they put you back in the shop. So yep. You've had to learn how to sell, correct?
Yep. Well, the way that I see it, at least in my experience, is I don't really do much selling at all, even these days. And when it comes to upselling, like, I don't really have to upsell or sell anything. I just say to the guy, I say, hey, look at your brake pads. They're very skinny right now. Or your tire's mm-hmm. a little bald. Or look at this number on the tire. It's too old. Mm-hmm. So I just show them. And most people are like, oh, well, gee whiz, I didn't know that. So, you know, they just make their own choice to purchase the thing. It's just my job to let them know what needs to be done. Right. So
now is that, and you could be the most amazing salesman and you're just being humble about it. Or I think there might be some other couple of reasons. And my first gut reaction is that you probably have a standing client list that these folks have probably seen you now 2, 3, 4, 5 times over your career as effectively being a mobile mechanic. What is your experience between the two, like your personal experience? So as somebody who's never come to you before and is utilizing your services for the first time versus someone who has, you know, this is like their second bike that they've utilized your services for. Is that a noticeable thing or where you feel like you have to sell on that new and then it's, you know, that experience and trust?
Not really. Like, yeah, you're right. Like most of my clientele is repeat, right? But even mm-hmm. for the newer guys, like the new clients and stuff, it's same thing. I just say, hey, look, this part. And like I was saying earlier, like even if you're not mechanically inclined, you can tell when a tire is bald, you know, I just have to point it out to you. And going back to the whole, you know, the bikes are more toys. The people are excited about it, right? Whereas let's say if you have to buy a, I don't know, a $600 part for your bike, could be a set of tires. it hurts less when it's on your toy versus your appliance, like a car, right?
Gotcha.
Yeah.
I think so there's something there to be said, though, because, you know, we quantify motorcycles as toys.
Yeah.
You know, power sports vehicles as toys, ATVs and UTVs and, you know, jet skis and things of that nature and stuff. But I think one of the things that you said there that I'm just kind of chewing on here a little bit is that they're excited, right? Mm-hmm. They're happy. They want to get the toy fixed. So how is it from a more commercialized process, like a dealership for cars, how do we get our customers, our clients, our guests engaged so that it feels, you know, we're never going to make them excited about spending $1,000 on a set of tires and brakes and an oil change. Like, they're never going to be excited to do that. But mm-hmm. how do we get them at least from where they are to that point where it's almost like they're having, you know, a motorcycle-like experience? And maybe there's something about that. We definitely need to noodle on that at some stage, and I'll noodle on that with the boys. Mm-hmm. 'Cause that's just kind of an interesting thought. How do we get them from where they are to being excited about the experience? How do we get them there?
That's a good question. Well, for starters, you're not going to get everybody excited.
No.
Right? Yeah. Now, as I was saying earlier, how I think about my sister, well, I've also got a couple of brothers, right? My one mm-hmm. brother, he's right into the JDM stuff, right? Like, he loves his cars and he's an enthusiast. My other brother, he's not really an automotive enthusiast. He's getting more into bikes, but he's the kind of guy that wants the best of the best. And he wants the best of the best. He wants it in the best shape that he can. He has a basic understanding of how everything all works with automotive and stuff. And then there's my sister. It's just an appliance, right? Mm-hmm. So it depends on the type of person that you're talking to, right? So mm-hmm. it's like, with my sister, it's more of like a reliability thing, right? It's like, look, your tires, they're getting a little old, they're getting a little bald, you know, they're cracked. They're not really supposed to be like that. And tires are kind of important. So she's not going to be excited about it, but if you explain it to her that way, then she reluctantly put the money out. Mm-hmm. My one brother, who likes the best things that he can get, he's going to research the best tires, right? So it's like, hey, look, mm-hmm. you know, your tires are getting a little bit old. This is what you got in here now. This is a new version from this other brand. It's very similar, but it's just a little bit better. He'll be like, all right. And then mm-hmm. my enthusiast brother, he's going to tell you what he wants, you know? He's like, yeah, look, the tires are getting worn. I was like, okay, no problem. I've watched the YouTube videos on this. I know a guy with those, so I want these. So it depends on who you're selling to.
Yes.
Right? And you have to communicate to them in a way that they will understand. Right? And I was just using tires as an example, right? Mm-hmm. But yes, some mm-hmm. people are just never going to be excited to drop that kind of money, right? Because, I mean, everything is expensive. You know,
it's getting more expensive. It's getting more difficult to get done. It's getting, you know, so on and so forth. And you know what? One of the things that I learned early on, and this is personal preference, when it comes to shopping for parts, especially when it comes to shopping for parts, and more specifically tires, my phrase was always, "Are we getting Michelins? Are we shopping for tires?" So how to phrase your bias to customers. And I've heard it said, you know, are we getting BFGs or are we shopping for tires and so on and so forth? But for me, it's always been Michelin's, at least in the car world, because I understand that Michelin is not the primary go-to in motorcycle world.
They're up there.
They're up there. But, you know, it seems that the Pirellis are always seemingly at the top, at least from conversations for the most part. Now, there's always different levels of spec tire. But, you know, I would suggest that most motorcycle service advisors are going to be like, are we getting Pirellis or are we shopping for tires? Mm-hmm. You know, that would be the kind of phraseology that they would use. So it's interesting how some of the things are similar and some of the things are not. You know, pay is different, but it's not. You know, for service advisors, automotive, motorcycle, pay is different, but it's not for motorcycle and automotive. You know, I know that there's shops out there that are flat rate for their motorcycle mechanics. And I know there's shops out there that are, you know, straight time or hourly as our friends to the South call it. And, it's interesting how the little nuances are different, but the core stuff is still a lot the same. So it doesn't matter what industry is. Most of the apprentices, people who have been an apprentice in Canada, had a fairly similar experience. They pushed a broom, they shoveled shit, took out the garbage, they got coffee, they ran the shuttle. You know, they were effectively a full-time bitch for a while, until, you know, I'd like the Rocky statement, you know, you show up for a period of time every day at the same time, on time, dressed appropriately, you work hard throughout the day, and you prove that you do that consistently day over day for whatever period of time that is. And, you know, you earn the trust and the credibility to say, hey, we now trust you with putting tools in your hand and putting the lives of our customers in your hands, because whilst I may very well be a journeyman and I'm going to be checking your work, I might miss something that you did because it's no longer my hands doing it. And then we have troubles, and that requires trust. You know, how we going about portraying it to these young folks coming into the industry, I think needs to change a little bit. But at the end of the day, it's building trust. And I think that's probably a great way to ask the last question is, what would be your one piece of advice? And it doesn't matter whether it's a young person, an older person in the trade. What's one piece of advice to help technicians be happier or healthier or more productive?
This isn't mechanic or trade specific. This goes for human beings in general. You got to take care of your body, right? And whatever way that looks like, you got to take care of yourself, you know, because like you could be working in the coolest shop, working on the coolest cars or bikes or whatever. But if your body's no good, then you're going to be miserable, you know. So, and wherever people are with that, it changes from person to person. But I would generally recommend just work out to any kind of capacity. You know, that could be going to the gym, lifting weights. That could be cycling or playing a sport, and have a decent diet. You know, there's not one diet that fits all, but you got to take care of your body, right? I made and take care of your skin too. Like I made a video a few weeks ago, maybe about a month ago, about gloves. You know, some guy gave me a hard time that I was wearing gloves. I'm like, well, dude, like I'm not trying to be cool with gloves. I just don't want to have terrible hands. You know, I still got
biggest
calluses.
Biggest organ in your body is your skin, and your skin absorbs like crazy.
Well, I had this two guys actually at that dealership. At the end of the day, they would go to the solvent tank and they would wash their arms in it, you know, and they were always like they had liver problems in their 40s, you know, and the one guy, I thought the guy was in his 70s. Dude was like early 50s. You know, his hair was all white. He was like bald here, white hair and wrinkly and like cracks all over the place. But he was just washing his arms every night in the solvent. You know, so you got to take care of your health, take care of your body, what goes in, what goes out. You got to move, you know, like take care of yourself.
Yeah, I'm definitely in that category. We're seven months beyond being on the bench. And it's obviously, it's noticeable in a lot of ways. And I very, very, very real humbling, scary moment when, you know, you go see the naturopath, you know, what can we do to better ourselves? What's our baseline? You know, all the basic naturopath testing done with blood and blah, 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 and comes back, I'm pre-diabetic. So I need to be doing some fairly major food changes on top of the fact that I have some food sensitivity stuff that I need to be careful of. So, you know, I took their advice, and, you know, the idea was I need to eat a whole lot, but I need to be eating a whole lot of the right stuff. So I have no idea what I'm doing with regards to this, because I've never done this kind of eating before in my entire life. And of course I'm 40 now, not 25. So, you know, and I'm not working 10 hours on the shop floor anymore. So me consuming an excess amount of calories a day used to just fall off, right? You know, go to the gym for 2.5 hours and it would fall off. I'm 40. I can't do that anymore. I don't have the time. Like for me right now, it's a struggle to try and get on the treadmill 15 minutes, 3 times a week. So, you know, I've put on 18 pounds since I came off the bench 7 months ago. So I got to figure out how to eat better, not just better, but how to eat more appropriately for what my body is obviously trying to do. And I have to be mindful of about my size and my weight, because I don't want to turn into my grandfather. I don't want to be, you know, I don't want to be 6 foot, but 350 pounds and have a heart attack.
Yeah.
Right? I don't want to be a diabetic. So I hear your statement very loud and clear. And for anybody else out there that's that's in our kind of category, especially the folk gentlemen out there. At if you're 40, go get tested, because some of that stuff could, you know, maybe save you from a couple of years of hurting. So I appreciate it. Yeah. I appreciate the piece of advice.
The unfortunate part is the diet is usually the hardest to change, right?
Yes.
Yeah. The working out and exercise, that's the easy part to develop a habit, at least. It's not easy for everybody, but it's, at least for me, diet is the hardest.
Yeah. And it's not just the food intake itself either.
It's the chemicals around you, the exhaust fumes, the solvent fumes, and yet.
The timing too, right? And it might be a little bit easier as an individual. Actually, I think it might actually be easier if I was back on the bench, because it's a little bit easier for me to step away for 5 minutes to eat something when I was on the bench than it is right now. Because if I get stuck in a meeting, you know, in the middle of the day, if we're on a sales call, or I'm doing a partnership meeting or trying to do coaching in the middle of the day, whatever the case may be, it's really hard to step away, because, you know, they can be anywhere from 20 minutes to 3 hours, depending on the circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
And part of the naturopath's advice was to kind of do a quasi intermittent fast to help my pancreas. Maybe it's my pancreas. I'm still learning the shit, but the idea is whatever deals with insulin to give it enough of a break. So I'm really only supposed to be eating twice a day, and then I need to be doing at least 6 hours between those two meals during the day, and trying to hit that at least 16 hours between the last meal and the first meal of the next day, to try and really get my body to absorb the stuff that I'm eating and do the correct stuff. So that change in philosophy of eating, going from, you know, eating breakfast, lunch, and dinner to just eating twice a day. So now I'm not eating necessarily the same time everybody else does. And, you know, there's folks out there having the same challenges as I'm having, and, you know, hopefully take both of our advice, right? You know, be conscious of your health, be conscious of what you're eating, try to get some exercise in, take care of your body, because, you know, this job is hard.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't matter what industry that we're fixing, cars, planes, trains, automobiles, motorcycles, whatever, it's hard. So we got to be in decent shape to be able to go to distance. So,
yeah. And well, for those listening, like, exercise doesn't always mean lifting weights. You know, you might play a sport on the side, could be something simple, or even like yoga, right? I do just as much yoga as I lift weights. And I've been doing that since I was a teenager, right? So, I don't know, if you're a heavy duty guy. Sorry?
That's really awesome.
Well, it's like, I saw what I would become if I didn't take care of my health, and I didn't like it. So, like, let's say if you're, I don't know, a heavy duty guy, and you're crawling under an excavator or something, right? And you're moving a lot of heavy materials, and you're lifting a lot of heavy things and all that. Well, maybe you don't need weights. Maybe you should do a little bit of yoga, loosen up, you know, the muscles and the joint. Just something is going to be different for everybody, but I recommend everybody just does something.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Good advice. And that's probably a good spot to say very much thank you for your time today, Hunter. Time is precious, and you've given us some. And there's lots of little tidbits in there for somebody to learn from, and, you know, your story and what you're doing, and a little bit, especially that ending health on advice. So again, appreciate your time, sir.
Absolutely. Likewise.
Awesome. Awesome. Yeah, folks,
fun. We ought to do it again sometime.
Exactly. And I think there's going to be opportunities presenting in 24. I had to back off the amount of content I was making in 23 because I was burning out, and I burned myself out for doing four different styles of content throughout the week on top of working more than full time, and then trying to be, you know, partner, as it were, in the back end for my wife for administrative stuff for her clinic. It was too much, and I burned out. So I want to start getting back into more content where possible and plausible, and that will be introducing new things. Like, I know that most of my content up to this point has focused heavily on automotive, but it's also got heavy duty, fleet, diesel, motorcycle. God willing, I've got a marine mechanic that I'm going to record with. I hope that I can make that happen because we can branch out a little bit there, so we can start to see some really diverse opinions on how our mechanic, as mechanics, as we grow irrespective industry, and really get some good feedback, some experiences, and some stories. So I think there's going to be opportunities to really try and collaborate with other creators. I'm hopeful. But I think as long as, you know, folk, like, your content is awesome, Hunter. Like, I really appreciate the stuff that you do, because one of the challenges with being a creator of any kind of content is that you can get very pigeonholed to what is trendy and what will get views versus what is beneficial, what has value, what is positive, what is the kind of message that needs to be heard. And I think you are one of those few who are not only making educational content, but it's entertaining and it's positive. It doesn't have that negative connotation to it that many do. So, you know, I really want to associate myself with those kinds of people who are pushing that educational and positive message. So I really appreciate for what you do.
Cool. I appreciate that. Thank you.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, folks, I think that's going to be the end of today's episode. But you know what, folks? There's going to be another one coming next week. So we got them lined up. I've got months of recordings here, folks, that we got to get out. So it's going to be on. You can hold me accountable to make sure that everything gets out here. So don't forget, we've got Wrenches for Wrenches bi-weekly newsletter coming out. We just dropped one there last week. Check out the LinkedIn page to check out the free version of Wrenches for Wrenches. Two, there's going to be a updated merch link here in the not-so-distant future, so check out all of the Spotify and the YouTube descriptions below to make sure that there is an updated merch link here in the not-so-distant future. And the one thing that we always have to do here, folks, is a quote to leave you on a one-to-one interview. And this one really struck home when I read it over the weekend while I was on the plane. Loyalty is rare. When you find it, keep it. Remember, folks, negative pushes, positive pulls, and always clean your toys before you put them away.